Hello, everybody. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, and you're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank our sponsor, Acme Smoked Fish, located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Acme's been a mainstay in New York's culinary landscape for over 55 years. They use an old-world recipe. They produce some of the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, and sable around. For more information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill Bay, or Ruby Bay products, visit www.acmesmokedfish.com. And we have a little giveaway today, too. If you call in live, our number is 718-497-2128. We have tickets to the New York Food Film Fest and also Porterhouse Pork Chops from Heritage Food USA. So call on in. That number again, 718-497-2128. And I'd like to introduce our lovely guest, Charlotte Druckman. I don't even know what I can say about you because you have so much to say. You have such a breadth of knowledge within food and design. She writes for New York Times Tea Magazine under the food section, has worked for Food and Wine. The section, tea section, which I love, is the We Made It Ourselves, which kind of is about the craftsmen and artisan food movements around the world. And I hope that the food scene is kind of akin to those ideas and aesthetics. And so thank you for coming on, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What's wonderful about Charlotte is that she has a background in art history. Where did you go to school?
I was an English major undergrad, and I took some art history classes as a minor. And something about it just, it was like, it just snapped for me. It just, everything came together. And so I decided I wanted to be an art history professor. Excellent. I just like got this notion in my head to be an art history professor. And so I went to the Institute of Fine Arts, which is the program that NYU does specifically for graduate work in art history.
Yeah. And so it's convenient to be around all these museums and then all the food that inspired.
It is. It's, I mean, I think any time you can do that level of work in a city like New York, and the school itself is two blocks away from the Met. It's in Doris Duke's old mansion. So you're literally, you know, it's like a literal feeder into the Met, and it's a pretty great experience.
Yeah. So,
but I'm not a professor.
No.
And I am a lapsed PhD student. Just, yeah. You know, so no one starts thinking that I, you know.
But she is going to school us in some food knowledge today. wanted to kind of lead into the ideas of art history, of Dutch alcoves, Italian futurism as two. That may be a starting point of how we see food, how we plate food, how we experience food today. From Dutch alcoves, I recently had Victoria Granoff, a wonderful food stylist, on, and she did Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. And people see that, and it has locavore, it has sustainable, it is Flemish, it is 16th century. What resonates and what is similar and striking from Dutch alcove paintings to today's food ideas?
Well, what I think is the most interesting, which maybe is a little weird, but I think that there's a darker side to Dutch alcove aesthetics, I guess. And there's also the idea of a moral. And even though we don't tend to express the moral side, I do think it's interesting that it was, you know, on Michael Pollan's book, because he really does have a point of view that's about ethics. So it's, you know, I have a feeling that might just be coincidental. But I think the amazing thing about Dutch alcove is that there's this idea of sort of death in life and decay. And in food, in the last, I would say the last decade, there's been this sort of celebration of what you could say is like the joli laid, right? It's all these things that were ugly or that aren't supposed to taste good. You know, suddenly we all embrace sardines and anchovies and offal and,
hey, it's ugly tomatoes. Yeah. I mean, they actually branded it.
Yeah. And I feel like it's really funny because on the one hand, everyone's been talking about the beauty of the Dutch alcove. I remember at this point, I think it's, you know, maybe 8 years ago, my first editorial job out of grad school was at Daily Candy, when Daily Candy was still really small. And I wrote up a florist who is in the East Village. And at the time, he was sort of like the hot florist. And that was his aesthetic. And we talked about what had inspired him. Food had inspired him. Film, a lot of Peter Greenaway films had inspired him.
Oh, we're going to talk about Peter Greenaway.
So I feel like this has been happening for a while, but that it, right now it seems to be expressing itself best through food. And that means visually, but also the actual food itself, you know.
Let's not even waste time to talk about Peter Greenaway.
Yeah, who's I love Peter Greenaway.
He's one of my favorite British authors. And unfortunately, I you know, show the movies and people suffer through them because they're for a specific type. I mean, they're cinematic opuses that are 3, 4, 5 hours long, amongst a couple of focal points, but food is a huge one in Cook, Wife, Thief, Lover.
Yeah, and art, food and art together. Yeah. There's always, they are always hand in hand in his movies. The Last Supper, I think there's that Hans Holbein painting, you know, in The Cook. It's they're always interconnected. Yeah. There's something, and they're also always visceral. So there's this combination of the food being, you know.
We got our first phone call. Caller, are you in?
Hello.
Hello, who is this?
Hi, my name's Jess.
Jess?
Yeah.
Thank you for calling into the food scene. I just like to thank you for listening. And unfortunately, we can't chat that much because Charlotte's got a wealth of knowledge that hopefully will entertain you. But I'm going to give you back to my producer, Jack, and congratulate you on winning New York Film Fest tickets and some beautiful porterhouse pork chops from Heritage Food
USA. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling in.
No problem. Have a great day.
You too. Cheers. Excellent. That was my first phone call. I think I handled it pretty well.
Congratulations. That's great.
Wonderful. So right back into Peter Greenaway.
Yeah.
Not just Cook, Wife, Thief, Lover. Another movie of his, which I'm smitten with, is Zed and Two Knots, also known as Zoo. The majority of that movie being about, you know, life and decay, in that they take all this food and produce and time-lapse photography it, watching it kind of demise.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting cycle that you touched on before, that people are understanding food in the way that there is the beautiful freshness, but there is also the compost.
Yeah, there's the compost, and then there's also, I mean, if you're going to get metaphorical, there's sort of all the waste in a sort of social sense. And I don't know, I feel like food has become this universal touchstone for so many different issues. You know, it can be socioeconomic, but then it can also be pop cultural and light and fun. It can be, you know, Adam Gopnik comparing the fooding to new wave cinema. But it's all food.
Yeah.
So yes, you can look at something like, you know, Dutch Alcove or just any heap of food, and suddenly you're seeing it in all these different ways that you never would have.
So it's not just aesthetic. It's what we're going to flow into is maybe synesthesia, you know. The Italian futurist movement in the 1920s started playing with things like dynamism, motion, but also trying to get away from, like you had mentioned before, the bourgeois sense of food. And their biggest slogan was Italy, no more pasta.
They, you know, it's very odd to have this idea of redefining nationalism by getting rid of the national food stuff, but they also had this idea, you know, without using our catchphrase, that you are what you eat. And there was this sense that pasta makes you sluggish and inert, and that you should be focusing on, you know, quality instead of quantity. But then they were also having fun with it, because they were making fun of the idea of taking food too seriously and, you know, having it be this sort of status symbol to say, well, I ate here and I ate this. And it's funny because it's so relevant now, you know. And so they were, I think, I can't remember what it was. There was some dish where it was literally, you know, they were really into machinery and steel and sort of people becoming machines.
Yeah, and like the architect Santa Elia built these giant steel structures, which were about metropolis, but also about the collapse of, you know, large construction.
Yeah, and there was, there's a dish of chicken where the chicken actually sort of marinates with steel.
Yeah.
It's sort of, so they try to infuse the chicken with steel flavor. And funnily enough, if someone wanted to spoof what some of our chefs are doing now, you could actually see, okay, maybe not steel.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be like the birch tree from their backyard, or, you know, their dog's poop, or, you know what I mean? But you kind of get to that stage of ridiculous, but there's something brilliant in it. And I keep wondering, like, I actually think that the futurists would have loved molecular gastronomy. I think they would have totally embraced foam because it's light. They were all about light. You know,
well, I mean, that's interesting that you bring that up. And, you know, from Grant Achatz of Alinea to Wiley Dufresne here in New York at WD50, to see them take these very scientific techniques, which the futurists themselves were taking towards interpreting, you know, their arts and architecture, back into food. There's much more of an understanding and playfulness now rather than before. It was, very kind of spoof.
It was spoof, but then also it was spoof because there was all of this sort of subtext that was political, which is like that idea of, you know, the body politic. So what is the body politic ingesting? Whereas now we've sort of gotten rid of that sort of political substance.
Yeah.
And it's really just, it's more artful in terms of aesthetics and just, you know, visual and playful without being absurd or too provocative.
Yeah. You know? I think I have to kind of give an example, too, of what Italian futurist ate, because there was an amazing cookbook that came out in 1932 by one of the leaders of that movement, Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, that these things dealt with, like Charlotte was saying, marinating chicken with steel, but elements that you wouldn't expect. And synesthesia, which is the reinterpretation of senses, like you would eat a soup while scratching sandpaper with the other hand, and someone would lick and blow on the back of your neck and trumpets would be sounding. So
it's performance art before they called it performance art, you know, or multimedia. Yeah. I mean, it's,
But then with molecular gastronomy, do you feel like multimedia has been put on a plate and people have forgotten that there's something outside of what's right in front of you? Adding audio, adding, you know, more sensory objects.
Well, I think this is where you can start to draw so many parallels between the sort of the haute food scene today and then what the art scene, art world was maybe in the first half of the 20th century. So I think that it becomes more of a form of entertainment, you know.
Yeah.
And what is interesting to me about molecular gastronomy is that there are very few cases in which people will have a molecular gastronomy experience and then the next day wake up saying, I want more of that. I crave it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that sort of, that's where you lose the kind of visceral connection to it. But I do think this idea that food is entertainment. I mean, Grant Achatz is about to start charging, you know, for tickets to his restaurant, has taken the idea, while, by the way, we have this huge problem with hunger in our country, it's really taken that notion that you eat, you know, to live, like, to an extreme case of, I mean, I guess form really, really trumping function.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say it isn't fun and amazing, but, you know, there's definitely a big discrepancy.
So, like, hedonism versus epicure.
Exactly. I mean,
which way has the balance shifted right now?
Yeah.
Speaking of Grant, if you don't know of his new restaurant opening up, it is truly thematic and theatrical that he's taking period pieces. I think one of them was Mongolia. I don't remember what century. And making a tasting menu purely of that. I think there are going to be quarterly menus or three a year, taking certain, I think Paris 1920s was one of them, which I'm very excited about.
And yeah, that one is actually, I want to eat that.
Yeah.
Some of the other ones are kind of like, I'm not sure about the Mongolian thing, but you know,
yeah.
It would be interesting to contemplate, but I don't know if I'm coming for dinner.
Yeah. Paris is, I said Paris because I'm thinking about France and an absolute Francophile, which Charlotte is as well, and just returned from Paris.
Yeah.
And love to even talk about maybe, you know, the early 1920s and like Nouveau in France. How did that start influencing the food there, or was the food first, like chicken and the egg kind of thing?
Well, I think that it's probably a perfect storm situation where you had this restaurant culture that had developed in, you know, the 19th century, and it was sort of hitting its peak, I think, in the beginning of the, you know, the 20th century. And there's that, again, it's funny, it's like the theme of our talk. There's that sort of at the height of sort of glamour, there's also this decadence. And I think that's really what was happening in the, you know, in the 1920s. And so everything, again, to go back to the form and function thing, it was really everyone was leaning towards form. And so I think that you were seeing that in this sort of, it was more about going to restaurants and having the experience of dining out as opposed to the actual, the food of it all.
Yeah.
And then you look at the design and it was all about the ornamentation. And I think those things are parallel. I mean, I don't know if they're really, you know, specifically parallel, but I think it's like, you know, the overall whole leads to this, you know, kind of idea of just having a lot of fun, really.
Yeah.
You know, and beauty and just, you know, hedonism.
Yeah.
To some extent.
So we're going to take a quick break right now, but I think it's going to be interesting coming back talking about farm-to-table food and whether or not that's form and function, hedonist, epicurean, who knows? You're listening to Michael Harlan Terkel, and this is The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. This is Michael Harlan Turkell, and you're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network with guest Charlotte Druckman today. And we're talking about art and food. Well, what the food scene is about, but most specifically, do movements influence the dining scene of today? And which ones? We left off kind of talking about the differences between form and function, you know, hedonism, Epicureans. And what would you consider this food-to-table movement? Is it utilitarian? Has it moved back towards function? Or is there still playfulness and fun in it?
Well, I do think there's always playfulness and fun in food. But I think the farm-to-table thing does come out of some bit of necessity just when you think of, whatever, me and my sweeping theories that I make up. But you think about sort of post 9/11 and that kind of isolationism that countries tend to take to after terrorists, things have happened, or after war or during war. So you get that sort of inward looking, trying to redefine yourself as a nation, that kind of jingoism. Then you have the economy fail, where you have people having to sort of catch as catch can, which somehow can lead to really creative enterprises. Yeah. You have all these problems with agribusiness. So again, I think that the farm to table thing is as much a thoughtful trend as it also came out of a certain necessity and a certain nationalist tendency. And what's interesting for me is that America, we sort of have to, I hate to say it, fabricate a bit of our national lore, especially when it comes to the soil or craftsmanship with food. We don't have the same history. We were talking about France, where this idea of terroir is so normal. You know what I mean? It's like whatever region you're from in France is so important to you, integral to who you are, integral to what you make, to what you eat. And there is this history of making these things, of making, whether it's caramels or making cheese, and there's so much pride in it. And our country, we don't have that kind of history. Our claim to fame is industry, it's marketing.
I mean, there is regionalism. I was just recently down in Alabama eating barbecue, and that's not something you're going to see in France often.
No.
And whether that grew out of necessity or just taste.
Yeah. Both. Yeah. I think it's a balance. But I mean, in terms of the actual, when you talk about these sort of like the products and that pride in the carrot. That's for a long time, our country has been really removed from that. So in a way, getting back to it has to be somewhat artificial. Yeah. But the hope is that it becomes
ingrained,
normal and ingrained. And my hope, I just don't, I fear that I don't want it to be a passing trend. I don't want it to be this thing where, for the next 5 years, every restaurant is farm to table. And then suddenly everyone's like, I think it'd be really cool to swing the pendulum and go back to importing.
Yeah.
And get really into, processed stuff. I mean,
yeah, if it's cheaper, less terrible. Yeah, it is a fear. And it's interesting, talking to a couple food stylists a couple shows ago about, what products clients want, and saying, well, it's out of season, it's imported, I can't get that, as easily as, you think I can. But then realizing that a lot of our food trends have their etymology and basis overseas.
Yeah.
Just like, Christopher Columbus coming over in his boat. So did a lot of the food ideas and trends. And we've lost a lot of what a Native American dish is. And only now is a slight revivalism in that.
But I also think that there's this sort of new American food that's happening, that's been happening, that is organic. I don't mean organic in the farm-to-table sense. I mean organic in that you have chefs who, without contriving it or thinking about it too hard, are taking items from different countries and cultures and putting them together simply because they taste good together and they're trying to achieve balance on the plate.
Can you cite a couple examples?
Well,
of that?
I'm biased because I'm writing a cookbook with Anita Lowe, but I think she's
The
most amazing example of that, because she really will she'll start with, take a fava bean.
Yeah.
She was just in Egypt and she was having a lot of fool and fava stuff, and she sort of started to think, okay, what can I do with this? I love this flavor. And so then she starts to pair it with squash. But she's not sitting there going, all right, I'm going to do Egypt meets France meets, Poland.
Yeah.
She's just thinking these are things that taste good together. And if you think about what America is and all the cultures that we are collectively, this is kind of the way that you would imagine American food to be.
Yeah,
right?
And then with terminology like fusion in the 80s, you know, it kind of almost destroyed the sense of melting pot. And
yeah.
I think, I have this picture in my head of when you say melting pot, it's just a stew that's kind of bubbling over and just like...
I think of Macbeth. I think of the witches.
And who wants to eat out of a cauldron, especially in these hot summer days?
No.
So to see somebody like Anita not only have that basis of worldly foods techniques, then use the experiential is awesome.
It's awesome, but I think a lot of chefs are doing it. I mean, I think David Chang is doing it too. Again, I don't think he, you know, ever sits down and thinks, I'm going to merge these cultures.
Yeah.
I think he just thinks, what's going to taste delicious?
Yeah.
And because he has this sort of, you know, vast mental encyclopedia of food, not just, you know, knowledge, book knowledge, but taste knowledge, he can sort of pull these things out. And, and I think that's what really American cooking is. I mean, or it's how we should be looking at it.
So it's kind of like a loss of culture and identity almost. It's just more about the experiences of specific, you know, icons or people.
Or it's, I always say it's like, if you were to take the idea of terroir and make it its most extreme self, it would be a person. A person would be a terroir. So if you think of, you know, the chef as a moving terroir that's always changing, like a palimpsest or something, then when you taste that chef's food, you're tasting their terroir. In which case, to me, it still feels somehow personal and, you know.
And it's kind of cool to think that they can move their epicenter.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, you can say I'm going to go to Japan, but then I grew up in a household where my, you know, parents were Moroccan and I have those memories. And then I'm going to go live in Texas. And, you know, it all starts to, you know.
There's a really interesting article in Food and Wine about Pierre Gagné, about how he kind of starts with an experience, an idea, you know, one being walking through the desert and seeing the landscape, or one being a Mark Rothko painting and using that as the inspiration for dishes, whether it be purely of the form of them or the emotion or, and I thought that was a really interesting thing to have people stop looking at, you know, technique and cookbooks and how to use that basis of knowledge to interpret, you know, emotion and experience.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you could say that, if you could predict a shift or hope for a shift, you kind of would like things to get away from, I guess, the cult of personality, which is like the whole
Living
celebrity
color.
Thing. Yeah. Which I'm
Vernon Reid, one of my favorite musicians of all time.
Me too. But you kind of think, if we've been living in that sort of manufactured celebrity thing, if it could shift from that to the cult of the personal, which I do think these chefs that we're talking about, I mean, these are really personal experiences that they're translating into food. And, you know, I think that's a much more interesting way to look. I mean, then you can get into the whole, again, with comparisons to art and, you know, film, the auteur and, you know.
L'Atelier lines.
Exactly.
What's an interesting shift is to talk about, you know, we made it ourselves, the kind of small craft goods, the artisans, the DIY. Why were you interested in writing about that aspect, that genre?
I'm always, always drawn to people who are really passionate about what they do. And one of the things that I find doing that column is that once you start to uncover the stories behind the pot of jam and you hear where these people are coming from, you're always surprised.
Yeah.
The detours that have been taken. And again, this is one of those other kind of, you know, lemonade out of lemon situations. But I think that, again, with the economy falling apart, you had a lot of people who had maybe always thought they might like to .. I might like to cure my own bacon. I might like to try, you know,
the elliptical food product.
Yeah, you know, and then it's sort of like, well, now I've got nothing to lose. And hey, I've got a farmer's market because now everyone's championing, you know, their local farmer's market. So why don't I just try it? But I also, I just love this, that sort of idea that you can spend so much attention on something so small, especially in the middle of this crazy fast-paced world where everything is so kind of global and also technological. And then you have these people who will literally just spend hours perfecting the bacon jam.
Yeah, so myopia isn't a bad thing.
No, you know? I think it's a great balance. And I also love this idea that you can't get something everywhere. When I was just in Paris and my favorite caramels, which I almost brought you today, but I thought they would melt because it's really hot out. But Jacques Genin, who's this chocolate maker, and he opened a shop in the Marais, I think about a year and a half ago. he happens to make the best caramels I've ever had. I mean, really. And you cannot get them unless you go to the store. His website is, I think at this point, it's even down. Like it's, you know, under construction and not working. They're sold nowhere else in France. I mean, you have to go to that store. And I have to say, I love that.
Yeah.
I think that makes it so special.
So what single entities in New York, in Manhattan, Brooklyn, do you resonate in that similar fashion?
I have to say, I love ice cream, and I'm really obsessed with the Milkmaid ice cream ladies. And I think they should be on this show because I just like how they think. And I can't remember which of them I think.
Their delivery service, right?
Yeah. So what they do is you subscribe. It's a subscription. And it is not cheap, but I think it's a great gift to give someone because it's this unexpected sort of, every month they make, you know, limited edition, two pints of ice cream that usually the flavors are seasonally motivated, and they try and work with other local artisans, and you pick your pint. You can either get both pints or you pick one pint, and they hand deliver, like they show up at your doorstep with your pint. It has your name on it.
That's awesome.
I mean, there's a little bit of a sort of a shtick going on, but the thing is the ice cream is amazing.
Yeah.
They're doing great things with
and
ice
what,
cream.
What are some of their flavors and inspirations?
Which is one of the ones I love. They just did a honey lavender one with this granola. And of course, now I can't. It's a Brooklyn-based granola. It's so good.
Early bird.
Yes. Early bird. I mean,
I love early bird.
It's so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they tell you where their lavender comes from. They tell you where, you know, their honey comes from. They go through all of it, but it's also delicious. So it's not just like, okay, yeah, we get the point. I mean, you sit there and you can finish the pint in one sitting. Yeah. They did a pear ice cream. Usually you see pear sorbet. They did a pear ice cream that had bits of crystallized ginger in it. That was just like sublime.
Yeah.
And I love this stuff. And it's funny because I was following them. People will sometimes ask me where I find my story ideas, and I just say that I believe in tangents because I really do. But Twitter has been, I follow their Twitter because sometimes they'll ask people to give ice cream flavor suggestions, and I do that.
Yeah.
Don't think they listen to me, but I do it. Anyway, they tweeted about this guy who they had met at, I think, the Greenpoint Market, who was making syrups and sodas, and they said, we want to team up with him.
Yeah.
And so I went and checked him out, P&H Soda Company. And
are they the same people that pour at Brooklyn Pharmacy, or are they separate of it?
I think they might be.
Yeah.
I think he just started, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's him. And anyway, I decided just to go check him out. He hadn't really gotten any press, and I started talking to him. And again, he's the most amazing, interesting guy. It's he and his wife that work on this together.
Yeah.
And it's just, and the sodas are, I mean, they're out of control. And so now the Milkmaid girls and, you know, the soda guy will get together at different markets, and they'll do, you know, like floats.
Yeah.
And it's just great. I love that. I love that sort of co-op, you know,
being the mediator for
wonderful
tangents.
Or just this idea that, I guess, you know, if you live in a rural place, then you're dealing with more actual farming and sort of backyard, you know, soil work. But I think in cities, the equivalent is this sort of co-op exchange thing where maybe one person brings the ice cream and then one person brings the syrup. And then, you know, someone else, I think it's a different kind of collaboration that yields really great things.
Yeah. So instead of just meeting your farmers, meet your local food producers, those craftsmen, those artisans, those DIYers. Get them together and see what kind of beautiful floats they can make.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you, Cheryl, for coming on, talking about pretty much everything under the sun today.
Thank
and
you
hope
for
to have you on
me.
Again. And
I would love to come back.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We got a lot more to say. And you've been listening to The Food Scene. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, your host. It's on Heritage Radio Network. Want to thank our sponsor again, Acme Smoked Fish, producer Jack Inslee, engineer Nat Wiener. And I'm telling you, go get one of those floats right now, because by the time I get to it, there's not going to be any left.